This parsha, Parshas Vayechi, deals with the end of Yaakov Avinu's life. And really the theme of the parsha is the theme of brachos, the theme of blessing, wherein Yaakov Avinu blesses Yosef, and particularly Yosef's two children, Ephraim and Manasseh, as well as blessing each one of his sons, each one of the tribes, each one with the blessing deserving for them. The parsha ends with both the death of Yaakov Avinu, his eventual burial in Eretz Yisrael, as well as the relationship of Yosef and the brothers after the death of Yaakov Avinu, and ultimately the parsha ends with the death of Yosef HaTzadik, the Jewish people, in a certain sense, beginning the decline, beginning the experience of the exile of Egypt. I'd like to raise two questions on this parsha, one more specific and one more general, that I think will give us a glimpse into the relationship, the final moments of Yaakov Avinu with his children, and just as important, a relationship that is so important between ourselves and our children, and Amir Tashem, our grandchildren, as well. The first question is based on a very famous medrash. The Torah tells us in the beginning of Perek Mem Tet, chapter 49, then Yaakov called for his sons and said, assemble yourselves and I will tell you what will befall you in the end of days. And the next pasuk says, gather yourselves and listen, O sons of Yaakov, and listen to Israel your father. And then it begins with Reuven and the subsequent brachos. So the Gorari and the Maharal explains, we do not find him saying what will happen in the end of the days in this passage. So the first pasuk says, I'll tell you what will be in the end of the days, but we never find what Yaakov Avinu says. This is because the Shechina departed from him, so he would not make this revelation. And that's the famous Rashi, Medrash, Rashi quotes on this pasuk, that Yaakov Avinu bikesh lagalot et haketz, he wished to reveal the end to them, v'nistaka mimenu Shechina, but the Shechina, the eminent presence of God, departed from him. And therefore he began to say other things. Medrash tells us that the final moments of Yaakov Avinu's life, he wanted to be Megale Taketz, to reveal the end of time. But for whatever reasons, the Shechina left him, and he was not able to do so, and instead he blessed his children. As we've learned, any time the Medrash is teaching us something, there's a tremendous amount of depth that we have to understand. So our first question is, what is the Medrash trying to teach us? What does it mean that Yaakov Avinu wanted to tell them something but was unable to do so? What indeed did he want to tell them? And why is it important that we know that he wanted to tell it to them even though he didn't tell it to them? Why is the fact that he wanted to impart something equally as important even though we don't know exactly what it was that he imparted or he wanted to impart? It's interesting that this idea that Yaakov Avinu, the Shechina left Yaakov Avinu, is really echoed in an earlier Rashi at the beginning of the parsha, where, as the article Stone Chumash notes, Vayechi is unique in that there is no extra space between it and the preceding parsha of Vayigash. In contrast to the general rule that a sedra begins on a new line, or that is separated from the previous one by at least a nine-letter space, therefore, Rashi describes Vayechi as a parsha stuma, a close, a condition that is meant to teach something about the mood of Yaakov's children when he died. So once again, we have the concept of the parsha being a parsha stuma, a closed parsha. There's a closed book aspect about this parsha that's associated with this parsha, with the death of Yaakov Avinu, and with the moments right before he died, another closed book where he is unable to tell us when the end of time will be. The second issue that has to be examined, aside from this concept of this stuma, of this closed, is why, if indeed he was unable to tell them what will be at the end of days, why does he then revert to blessing them? Why is that a bimkom? Why is that a replacement for what indeed he wanted to tell them? How are we to understand the mindset, in this case, of Yaakov Avinu? What is the Medrash trying to teach us? What is the Pasuk trying to teach us? That's question one. Question two is a much broader question, and we know that this parsha is Parshat Chazak. It's the culmination of the book of Bereishit, And we know the book of Reshit is really the Sefer HaYetzirah, as a rabbi's note, the book of formation. It's the book where everything is laid down and everything that follows is really the blueprint, the building of the blueprint from Sefer Bereishit. We need to understand why is this the culmination of the book of Bereishit. Book of Bereishit, which begins, Bereishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz, where God is creating the heavens and the earth. Why does the Torah end the book of Bereishit with the story of Yaakov Avinu and the death of Yaakov Avinu and the blessings to his children? And I think the question really can be driven home on a much more deeper level in trying to understand why does Parsha, Sefer Bereishit, Parsha Vayechi, end the way it does. So if you want to say to me it's ending with the death of Yaakov Avinu, the death of the Avos, so perhaps I can understand that. But the last few psukim in the Parsha seem like a little bit of an odd way to end the Parsha. If you take a look at the end of the 50th chapter, the Pasuk says, beginning in Pasuk 22, Yosef dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Yosef lived 110 years. Yosef saw three generations through Ephraim. Even the sons of Machir, son of Menashe, were raised on Yosef's knees. Yosef said to his brothers, I'm about to die, but God will surely remember you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Yitzchak, and to Yaakov. Then Yosef adjured the children of Israel, saying, when God will indeed remember you, then you must bring my bones up out of here. Yosef died at the age of 110 years. They embalmed him, and he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. So the second question is, why does Parshat Vayechi end the book of Bereishit? And why does Parshat Vayechi end with really the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren of Yosef, and making the brothers swear to bring up his bones from Egypt? Once again, I'd like to take two approaches to try to understanding these two issues and to see how we can relate these approaches to our own lives, to the own our own legacy that we wish to leave our children with God's help. The first approach, we need to understand what the last 17 years of Yaakov Avinu's life was like in Egypt. Torah tells us at the beginning of the parasha that Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. The days of Yaakov, the years of his life, were 147 years. Very fascinating, Tana de Eliyahu, the Medrash writes that these years were Yaakov's Me'ein Olam Haba, a semblance of the world to come. Vayechi Yaakov, and he lived, that these years, explains the Manchester Rav, based on this Tana de Eliyahu, were the best years of his life, even better than those of the Academy in Shein Be'ever, even better than those spent in the spiritual haven of his father's home. And he says one of the reasons for this, very fascinating understanding, he says, for 22 years he had mourned over his precious son Yosef, believing him to be dead. And during those years, Ruach HaKodesh, his divine spirit, which is manifest only upon one who is in a state of joy, did not rest upon Yaakov. It was only when he heard that Yosef HaTzadik was still alive, so Pasuk tells us, Vatechi Ruach Yaakov Avihem, and the spirit of their father Yaakov was revived. Meaning that his Ruach HaKodesh, his divine inspiration, returned. He says so beautifully that we know human nature is such, is that when a person comes upon something precious, after having been deprived of it for a period of time, he clings to it with a heightened degree of affection. We notice ourselves in our own lives, if we have something very precious and we misplace it, and then we find it, so it becomes more endeared to us. When Yaakov felt his soul becoming bound up once again with the divine spirit, after a separation of so many years, his soul became ignited with spiritual desire, and he soared to heights that he never before reached. He was able to attain new levels of spirituality, even while surrounded by the moral decadence of Egypt. These 17 years of Yaakov Avinu's life were really the best years of his life. They were the Me'ein Olam Haba. And the Or Gedayahu, Rav Gedayah Shur, echoes this idea in a fascinating, fascinating insight, where he says that we know that there were four major troubles that befell Yaakov Avinu. He had problems with Lavan, he had problems with Esav, he had problems with his daughter Dinah, and problems with Yosef. All four of these troubles parallel the four Malchios, the four kingdoms, as Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, underwent. We discussed in the past weeks how the four kings that Avraham fought with, the Parsha Lech Lecha, was the harbinger of the Arba Malchiyot. So here we see in Yaakov Avinu's personal life that these four are parallel. And the Gedayahu in different places explains the parallel. Like, for example, the story of Dinah is parallel to the story of Yavan, wherein one parallel is that both happened in the land of Israel. Well, Lavan happened outside, and Yosef was connected to a certain degree with that which happened in Egypt. Dinah happened within Eretz Yisrael and Shechem, likewise the story of Yavan, and he finds a tremendous amount of similarities between those two stories. And clearly, Yosef, who we know will extinguish the flame, which will extinguish all the straw, all the materialism of Esav, represents the Golus that we're in now. And therefore, when Yaakov Avinu is living these final 17 years of his life, he's really living beyond the four Golus, beyond the four exiles, into a level of Olam Haba, into a level of the world to come. This is the level that Yaakov Avinu reached. It's with this understanding that we can have better insight into the blessing that Yaakov Avinu gives to his son Yosef. The Torah tells us that in chapter 48, verse 15, he blessed Yosef and he said, O God, before whom my forefathers Avram and Yitzchak walked, God who shepherds me from my inception until this day, may the angel who redeems me from all evil bless the lads, and may my name be declared upon them. Very famous Hamalach HaGoel. And the names of my forefathers Avram and Yitzchak, and may they proliferate abundantly like fish within the land. So here, the Matnat Chaim notes that Yaakov Avinu uses a very fascinating term in his relationship with God. And it's the first time such a term has ever been used in relationship with God. And that is God who shepherds me. God is referred to here as a ro'eh, as a shepherd. Halokim haro'eh oti me'odi ad hayom hazeh. So ask the Matnat Chaim, what was Yaakov Avinu trying to convey by using this aspect of God's name? We've seen before Yaakov Avinu using different names, Kel Shakai, or different names of God that Yaakov Avinu uses in different situations, and each one is significant. So what is the significance for the first time introducing God as a ro'eh, as a shepherd? So Matnat Chaim explains that it's really the same understanding of what that famous capitul, the 23rd chapter of Psalm, is about, of Mizmor LeDavid Hashem Roi Lo Echsa, that Akash Baruch Hu David HaMelech describes as a Roi, as my shepherd. So he quotes a very famous understanding of the Ruach HaChaim, Rav Chaim of Elashin, on Pirkei Avos, where he says that one's true faith to Akash Baruch Hu is described by David HaMelech as relationship between a shepherd and one sheep. Likewise, just like a sheep follow the shepherd, but almost like blindly, likewise we ourselves follow Kadosh Baruch Hu. And he draws this imagery even further, and he says, when sometimes sheep wander off and they say, you know, we like to pasture in this piece of land, and the shepherd will take the sheep and say, no, this isn't a good place to eat now. Here's a better place. Here's a makom mered dashen v'tov. Here's a better place to eat. And this movement away from where we think is a better place to where the shepherd knows is a better place is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does with us all the time, where he moves us in life. He brings us into different situations which we know will be better for us. Even though in our mind, this is a great place to pasture. Leave me alone. HaKadosh Baruch Hu pushes us on. And likewise, sometimes the sheep want to rest right here. And the shepherd says, no, it's time to go on. Kisham mei menuchos. There's a place where you'll be able to drink and really rest. Al mei menuchot yina aleni. And that's why the shepherd and likewise the HaKadosh Baruch Hu direct us as well. Just like a shepherd understands what is best for his sheep, likewise, HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what's best for us. And that's why the capitul goes on to say, Shiftecha u'mish'antecha heima yinachamuni. Both the Shevet, and the Shevet is usually known as the stick, as the more forceful, the Midas Hadin, the judgment aspect of God, as well as the Mishantecha, the walking stick, which is the Makel Noam, the softer approach, the Midas HaRachamim, the one out of love, Hema Yenachamuni, both of them are going to comfort us, both of them direct us, both of them show us what's the proper place in life. And that's why Yaakov Avinu, after he's gone through everything he's gone through, living in Egypt in these last 17 years, Me'el Olam Haba, has the ability to have the perspective of everything that transpired in his life. He's able to say that it's Ha'alokim Haro'eh Oti Me'odi Ad Hayom Hazeh. It's the Kadosh Baruch Hu as the function of a Ro'eh who has led me until this point. And even though there have been tremendous sorrows and tremendous difficulties, and perhaps I don't understand the reason for all these difficulties, nevertheless, I understand, in retrospect, that Kadosh Baruch Hu is the Ro'eh, he's the shepherd who knows what's best for his sheep. And that's why, says the Matnas Chaim, perhaps that's why the word Ro'eh is written chaser here, missing a vav, to spell out the same words as ra'ah, as negative things. That which we perceive to be bad is really a function of the Ro'eh, a function of the shepherd. This idea, this insight of being able to see a Kadosh Baruch Hu as a Ro'eh is what Yaakov Avinu really wanted to give over more than anything else to his children. Not only the cognitive understanding of Ro'eh, but to really help his children see that point by point in life, Kadosh Baruch Hu is a Ro'eh. And that's how Rabbi Katz, the Living Inspired, explains what does it mean that Yaakov Avinu, going back to the original Medrash, wants to be Megaleh et HaKeitz. So he says it's a common and superficial error to understand that what was almost revealed at that highly charged moment was a date. The issue was not simply a practical date and time where Yaakov Avinu wanted to say, Mashiach is going to come in year so-and-so. It's much more than that. What Yaakov Avinu was about to reveal was a pathway. He was about to indicate to his sons and the Jewish people how history works. An outcome of such understanding would be the eventual date of the coming Mashiach, but that's not the point. The agony of not knowing is not simply because we do not have the specific date. Rather, it is because we cannot understand how everything in our history is inexorably forming the tapestry which the final stage reveal as complete. An understanding of the hashgach, of the divine conduct of worldly affairs at every turn of history, will be far more illuminating than an isolated date. But that was not to be. Our ordeal throughout history exists exactly because we cannot identify the mechanisms of hashgach. All we can do is maintain the faith that somehow every event in our life as a people is an essential element in the building of our final happiness. We know that the seed is falling to earth will sprout, but it's hard to believe until it happens. What Yaakov Avinu wanted to teach his children, what he wanted to really convey to them, was to show them how Kadosh Baruch Hu is a Ro'eh step by step, leading the sheep, certain pastures in this time, certain rivers in this time. The Shiftecha and the Mishantecha. The both sticks. That's what he wanted to show them. That's what he wanted to Megala. But that's where Kadosh Baruch Hu said no. This has to be room for faith within the children of Israel. This is the aspect where we need to take the initiative and show this faith. But it's a fact that Yaakov Avinu wanted to tell us this, gives us the impetus to understand that there is a Ro'eh, that there is a system. And that's how Rabbi Miller in Shabbat Shirim explains what the Medrash means, that Parshas Vayechi is a Parsha Stuma, is a blocked opening Parsha. The Zohar in this says that whatever Yaakov wanted to say, he said, but in a way that combines openness and reserve. Rabbi Miller explains this to mean the following. He says that this area between not speaking at all and communicating the full intensity of the truth, of them understanding every step of the way the Ro'eh, the God is the shepherd, is the battle line of faith. On this front, man is left to strive for himself, to advance into and beyond the shadow. Faith is the creation and achievement of man. And this was the message that Yaakov left to his children, the testament that he handed to them on his deathbed. And it's with this that Rav Tzadok HaKohen refers to an explanation by Rashi of the intervals that occurred between one occasion of God speaking to Moshe and another. Why indeed do we have a break between parshios? So we know that the break was to allow time for Moshe to absorb what he'd been told and bring the full action of his intellect to bear on each part before proceeding to another. But on the subject of Yaakov's death, however, and on the message he passed on to his children, the commentator remarks that in this case no amount of intellectual consideration will be of avail, and that again may account for the lack of any interval between the two portions. No mental consolidation was called for, and therefore no space is given. The nature of this passage is a matter not of intellectual comprehension, nor the mystic apprehension of truth that has a clarity of intellectual knowledge. Instead, it's a matter of amuna. It's the handing over the legacy of struggle and intense effort to penetrate shadows that seem only to be substantial. It's the bitterness of exile felt in the flesh, yet threaded with the gold of faith and trust in God. And Rabbi Miller ends by saying there are no shortcuts. It's only through faith, the belief that God is all wise and all good, can man save himself from despair and win at last this absolute understanding that Yaakov Avinu had. There is no space between Parshas Vayechi and Parshas Vayigash because it's not an intellectual understanding that Yaakov is giving over to his children. Galus is really emuna. Galus is faith. Exile means that you have to hold on to everything in our relationship with God with all the tenacity we can. We don't understand oftentimes why things happen, but that just means we have to redouble our faith to understand that Yaakov Avinu wanted to give this over to us, but was prevented from giving over these details. And indeed, to a certain degree, not knowing the date, having to struggle with this faith, is what makes us really stronger people. As Rabbi Tauber, based on the writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe and the Inside Story, notes, he says, "The final redemption we know is a divine act. But if man is to play a meaningful role in bringing it about, it is through deeds that are themselves unequivocal and internal. Hence the state of Gullut in which we find ourselves, a state of physical and spiritual displacement, a state in which God's guiding hand in history is hidden and our lives seem abandoned to chance and caprice. When a person yet retains his integrity and loyalty to God, even under such conditions, he is manifesting an eternal commitment, a commitment unshakable by time and place. Thus, exile is not only something from which we need to be redeemed, but really the condition that enables our meaningful participation in the redemption process. Exile means being in the dark, inhabiting a world in which a corporal husk obscures its rich spiritual content, a world that is deaf to chimes of the cosmic clock of history. Only under such conditions are our positive deeds vested with the eternality that categorizes the messianic. Were we privy to the end of days, our deeds would be of a provincial nature, buttressed by a clear vision of history's progression toward perfection. Since we don't have this understanding, everything we do takes on meaning. Everything we do is a reflection of our faith, and therefore that which we do is invested with so much more that if we saw everything so clearly, and in, so to speak, we'd be forced to act the way we act. Now when we act, now when we struggle, now when we're able to find light within the darkness, that's what really makes the difference, and that's what makes us so special. And this is really the challenge of Gullus. It's the challenge of uncovering the stuma, as the Sfas says, to be able to reveal the concealed holiness that Yaakov has buried in Gullus. And we know that concealed holiness is emuna, is faith, is the roeh, is the shepherd. And that, says the Or Gedaliahu, perhaps is what it means that Yaakov Avinu never died. Mazaro b'chayim afu b'chayim. Just like his children are around and alive, so too he is around. Which means that we have within each one of us this spark from Yaakov Avinu, the spark that can be ignited of the roeh, of the faith, of the emunah. to try to bring this idea a little bit down into the world of the practical, I think it has tremendous implications for our lives. Till now, we've really been dealing with the concept of galus on a national level. Wherein Yaakov Avinu was trying to explain to his children that no matter what experiences the Jews go through of the four exiles, understand there's a roa, understand there's a shepherd, be able to hold on to that spark which is stuma, which is hidden in Parshas Vayechi, the unintellectual ability, you can't fathom it intellectually, to be able to hang on to the semuna. And in so doing, we really develop a much stronger relationship and connection with God. But as we know, life is not only about the gullus of the national level of the Jew. Life is very much, and the lessons are very much pertinent to the gullus of each individual, the personal exiles, the personal darknesses that every individual goes through. There's a message, which is a very important message, that no matter what we go through in our lives, where we don't understand how God is shepherding us, the message that Yaakov Avinu was trying to reveal to his children, the legacy that Yaakov Avinu was giving to his children, was understand that God really has a meaning and a purpose in everything that he does. There's a direction in everything God does. And that's our challenge. Our challenge when things seem so dark in life, when we don't understand why things are happening, to hold on to that spark of Yaakov Avinu, to hold on to the spark of Emunah. And perhaps this is the greatest gift a parent can give a child. The gift of the ability to have the spiritual understanding of the world and the concept of Emunah to be able to hold on to God. Rabbi Twersky, beautiful book, it's not as tough as you think, explains that we know that to be human is not just the intellect. Because the intellect alone, a person can be very erudite, is really self-centered. What really distinguishes a human being from other forms of life is the ability to do acts of loving kindness. But more importantly, there are other things just as important as that, as the capacity to improve oneself, the capacity to contemplate the purpose of existence, the capacity to make free moral decisions. And what they're all really trying to say, the common denominator is, it's not directed only to self-gratification. When a person exercises the various capacities of the spirit, he's being spiritual. And he notes that dedicated parents are diligent in providing the optimum health care for their child. Make sure their kids get their shots on schedule as they should be, and they take the kid to the doctor every time they have an ear infection or kid has a fever, enabling him to have a healthy body. They are likely to avail him of the finest educational resources to develop his intellect to the fullest. But the same diligence is not always directed toward the third component, the spirit. And just as the laxity in care of the mind and the body may result in their being defective, so may laxity in the development of the spirit result in a defect. The greatest thing to give to children is the ability of a spiritual understanding of this world, that the world has a meaning, the world has a purpose, there is a direction in this world. There is a movement on a larger level to understand in this world. And he ends this particular little essay by saying we must bear in mind that the didactic teaching is rather ineffective. Our children may not do what we say, but they are more apt to do what they see us do. The most effective way of teaching spirituality is to show our children, is to model for them. And by the way we live, we show them how this is done. And perhaps one of the greatest things we could give over to our children is what Yaakov Avinu wanted to give over on the day of his death. The understanding of emunah, of faith in God, that there is a purpose and a meaning for everything that happens in life. There is no way that we can be with our children as they go through the ups and downs and the bumps on the road in life. Whether it's the bully in kindergarten, whether it's not being chosen for a play, the sitter play or whatever play it is later in life, and as the kid grows older, there are more difficult bumps in the road, greater disappointments in life, disappointments in relationships, disappointments in not finding a spouse and not having children. Whatever it may be in life, disappointments with our marriage, with our children, whatever disappointments are in life, there's no way a parent can hold a child's hand throughout life. But a parent can, through modeling, show that there is a system in life of understanding that we need to hold on. And even when we have difficulties in life, we have to pick ourselves up and go beyond. And the parent, with the understanding that life has meaning, life has purpose, and we have the ability to take the setbacks in life and use them to improve and use them to grow bigger and better. To have the last 17 years of our life as the culmination of the Ro'eh, of being able to see things in perspective. This is the greatest gift we can give our children. And it's perhaps, as the Orgat Ayahu notes, that this is why, on one level, the Sefer Breishit ends with the story of Yaakov Avinu. Because the story of Yaakov Avinu is the story of this Achris HaYamim, of the future times, of being able to reach this plateau. And therefore, it's really the model that we too, as a nation, will reach this plateau of the Achris HaYamim. But it really goes much deeper than that. Because the Parsha ends with the vision of Yaakov blessing his children as well as his grandchildren Ephraim and Manasseh. And the Torah ends that last part that we saw of Yosef seeing great-grandchildren, seeing children from his children's children. This is the message where Sefer Breishit ends. The point of life, the point of Torah, is to be able to give over a legacy, is to give over a mission, is to give over meaning and purpose in life. And this is what Yaakov Avinu wanted to do with his children. I think they say that stories say more than can be put into words. I'd like to share, I'd like to really read the selections from the last chapter of Rebbetzin Esther Jungreich's book, The Committed Life. The chapter is called The Legacy of Grandparents. She describes in this chapter her last visit with her grandparents in Hungary right before Hitler came to power. She describes how they made the long journey to visit her grandparents, and on the day before their departure, she went into, Rebbetzin Jungreich, as a young child, went into her Zadie's, went into her grandfather's study, knowing that that would be the last time that she'd ever be able to go in there and be the last time they would see each other. And as she walked in there, she saw that her Zadie was crying. And she became very frightened. And she started screaming to her father, "Tati, Tati," I said, "Zadie is crying." And now I'm going to quote from the book, page 327. She says, "Come," my father said, "let's take a walk outside and I'll explain to you why Zadie is crying." My father dressed me in my winter coat and boots. The snow had stopped falling, but in the yard it was still quite deep and walking was difficult. "I will walk ahead," my father said, "and you, my precious child, be sure to follow my footsteps." We had walked only a short way when my father paused and pointed to the path he had made in the fresh, clean snow. Bending over me, he asked gently, "Do you know why I walked ahead of you?" "Yes," I readily replied, "so I could follow in your footsteps and not fall." My father nodded, his eyes expressing satisfaction with my answer. "But it's not only in deep snow that a parent must make a path for his children. There is another road, a road that you, my child, do not understand just yet. It is that road which your Zadie is preparing for us with his tears. When your Zadie studies the holy books, he not only studies to acquire knowledge for himself, but he studies in order to make a path for you, my child, and for all his children. As Zadie pronounces each word, he prays that we may be able to withstand the terrible trials that loom ahead. We don't know, my child, where destiny will take us. The snow, my child, will be very deep, and very often you will find it difficult to walk. You may even fall, but then you will have to remember that beneath the snow is a path that Zadie blazed for you with his tears. You need only search for it to find it. God will give you the strength to stand up, to continue on the path that Zadie is paving for you with his tears." I was a little girl at the time and did not fully understand the importance of my father's words, but the memory of my Zadie's tears never left me. And when destiny called upon me to walk through deep snow, snow that was deeper than I could ever have imagined, I heard my father's voice whispering prior to me on, "Your Zadie made the way for you. You have only to follow in his footsteps." This is the message and legacy of Yaakov Avinu. And this is the message and legacy that we need to leave our children and equally important, our grandchildren and future generations, as Sefer Bereishit ends with the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of Yosef, that there is a legacy that we're leaving them, that we are paving the ways with our actions, with our faith, with our tears, that they're able to absorb into their being as children and as adults, and that's their fiber of their being in their relationship with God. And so often it's not done with words, it's done with tears, it's done with action, it's done with this commitment that we display in our relationship with God and with those around us, that our children absorb through osmosis and carry it on from generation to generation, that they too can walk through the snow of the difficult exiles and difficulties in life and have the way paved for them by these tears. That's the first message of the parsha, the message of teaching our children purpose, meaning in life, direction in life, spirituality in life. The second message of the parsha is an idea that we really dealt with at length last year, but I'd like to touch on it again this year since it's so important. We know that there's a famous custom that in many families on Friday night, the parents bless their children. And they bless the young ladies, that their daughters, by saying, "May God make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, Rachel, and Leah." And the sons are blessed that they should be Yisimcha Elokim ke'Ephraim u'k'Menashe. They should be like Ephraim and Menashe. So you look at this, it seems a bit odd. I understand why you want to bless a child to be like Sarah, Rachel, and Leah. These are the Imahos. These are our models. But how are we to understand that we're blessing our children like Ephraim and Menashe? Even though so the Pasuk says, B'chai Yivarech Yisrael, this is how it's going to be. But wouldn't it make more sense to also add as well, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? I mean, Ephraim and Menashe were great people, but can you compare them to the Avos HaKadoshim? Why is it that we bless our children to be like Ephraim and Menashe? And there are many answers given to this. But I think one answer is to understand a deeper approach of what it was all about, the blessing of Yaakov to Ephraim and Menashe. We know that when after the blessing, in chapter 48, verse 17, the Torah tells us that Joseph saw that his father was placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, and it displeased him. So he supported his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head to Menashe's head, because Menashe was the oldest. And Joseph said to his father, "Not so, father, for this is the firstborn. Place your hand on his head." To which Yaakov responds, "Yes, I know. Don't worry. But the younger brother is going to be even greater than the older one." So there's a lot of written on what's going on here. Is it just a matter of switching the hands? Why is it indeed, after all the sibling rivalry that we had, that here we show favoritism to the younger Ephraim over Menashe? So one approach, a very fascinating approach, that Nesiva Shalom brings down, the Slomin Rebbe, is that Ephraim and Menashe represent two aspects of our Avodas Hashem. And these are really the two aspects that we bless our children with on Friday night. Menashe, we know, comes from the concept his name means, Ki Nashani Elokim et Kol Amali et Kol Beit Avi. Kosh Baruch Hu has made me forget all the difficulties that transpired in the past. Menashe represents the aspect of forgetting of the Sur Meira, of removing ourselves from the negative. While Ephraim was called Ki Ephraini Elokim Be'eretzoni, Kosh Baruch Hu allowed me to multiply. It's the Aseh Tov, it's the positive. These two children represent two aspects in the Avodas Hashem, in the service of God. Menashe represents the Sur Meirah, the Yiras Elokim, the fear of God, the awe of God. While Ephraim represents the Aseh Tov, the positive aspects, the Ahava, the love to God. And that's why Nesiva Shalom explains, when Yaakov Avinu saw these children, he says, "Mi Eila, who are these?" Very famous Hasidic understanding is that the word "Mi Eila" spell out the word Elokim. What he's really asking for is, where did these children come from that they're Oved et Hashem, that they serve God with so much focus on Elokim? To which Yosef answered, "Banayim asher natan li Elokim bazet." That these were the children who were given to me in Egypt. In Egypt, the primary focus has to be to stay away from the evil influences around us. And this is really the message that Yaakov is giving Yosef. He says, I understand what your thought was, that you have to put a primary emphasis on Sur Meira. But in reality, the higher level is the Ephraim, who by nature is the Aseh Tov, is the positive aspect of being fruitful and multiplying and growing. The right hand is on the Ephraim, is on the Ava, on the love of the Aseh Tov. This was the argument between Yaakov and Yosef, where Yosef was saying that you need to focus first on Sur Meira, staying away from the negative, and then the Aseh Tov, and then the do good. Well, Yaakov Avinu was saying is that there's so much power in the Aseh Tov, in the doing good, that that's where the focus should really be. And I think by extension, we can take this and see the Shalom idea perhaps, and say it really relates to chinuch, to raising children as well. In a real sense, in the aspects of the Sur Meira, of staying away of the negative mitzvahs in the Torah, in a real sense, everyone is equal. So if there's a piece of non-kosher food on the table, so you tell all your children, don't touch this food. So clearly, all the children may have a different mindset of what this means, but their actions are all going to be the same. They are going to refrain from eating, they're going to refrain from speaking, they're going to refrain from doing that which they shouldn't do. What makes a child unique, where you see the real individual aspects of a child, are in the aspects of the Aseh Tov and the aspects of the positive aspects. The real message, the real challenge of a parent is the ability to be able to focus on each and every child, yes, on one level, of the Sur Meira, of being a Menashe, making sure the children don't transgress. But there's more of an emphasis has to be placed on the Aseh Tov, on the positive aspects of Torah and Mitzvot, and really directing every child to that which makes them unique in the Aseh Tov. Where one child might really excel in visiting old age homes, while another child might excel in doing another type of mitzvah. And to be able to understand the natures of each child, and to really allow each child, Hifrani, to grow and to multiply, and to really blossom in those areas which make them unique. To bring a very shy and resistant child to an age home is going to hurt the child. You take one of your outgoing children, or someone who can handle it better than another child. Perhaps this child likes to cheer up little children. Wherever it may be, yet when you understand the nature of the children, in order to be able to help develop them in the Aseh Tov, that they can find Torah and mitzvot a positive experience, an experience which really reflects who they are, that they can find their Avodas Hashem, their service of God. And on this level, on a much more sophisticated level, is what Yaakov Avinu was doing at the moment that before he died. Yes, he wanted to reveal the kates, he wanted to reveal the end, but instead he blessed them instead. What does this mean? So Rabbi Leff in Outlooks and Insights notes that the greatest blessing that one can bestow is to enlighten another and acquaint him with himself. Self-knowledge of one's abilities and talents, as well as one's shortcomings and limitations, the Ephraim and the Menashe, is the greatest blessing. It is the means enabling one to realize his divine mission in this world. Yaakov realized that the ultimate redemption depended on the development of his son's potentials, the potential inherent in their names. Rather than reveal the deadline for redemption, he opted to bless them with self-knowledge that could help them bring the redemption at a much earlier date. In this vein, knowledge of the capabilities they possessed was itself a blessing. This is a deeper understanding of the Medrash, that Yaakov wanted to reveal the cates, but then he stepped back as if, meaning the Shekhinah was concealed from him. He decided on an alternate route. Instead of giving them the final date when Mashiach was going to come, he said, I will do something which will be much more beneficial for the children. I'll give each one of them an understanding of who they are, of what makes them unique, what makes them special, and if they're able to really utilize themselves and everything they're made up of and all their spiritual content, so then they'll be able to bring the cates, the end, that much closer. It is on this level, the concept of bracha, the concept of self-knowledge, that this is why the Torah ends where it does. As the Orgadayahu explains, the Torah begins with the book of Breishit, which is a book of bracha, a book of creation, and we know creation means the building, the blessing that was found in the world. So he says, the Sefer Misayim Birkat Yaakov, it ends with the blessing of Yaakov, Shibirkato Haya, which his blessing essentially was, L'chol ha'pratim shel ha'briya, of everything of creation, should spread out, but each one of them should be able to unite back to themselves and to the community. Shekol ha'pratim chozrim el ha'reshit, v'kulam dvekim b'ha'reshit. At the ultimate goal of a blessing, the ultimate goal of the self-knowledge, is to really be able to bring everything back to God, to bring everything back to the creation. The blessing of self-knowledge is a blessing on two levels. On one level, it's a blessing where every child has the ability to get back to the first word of Bereishit, of the beginning, to get back to understanding our relationship with God. And that's really what the whole life is really found. Vilna says the entire Torah is found in the first couple of words of the Chumash. A Bereishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. On a deeper level, in the beginning, God created two concepts. He created the concept of Shamayim, which Rabbi Katz, based on Rav Moshe Shapiro, explains, comes from the word Sham, meaning there, and Aretz, which means the land, the world, which is based on rocks to move. There are two aspects of life. There's Shamayim and Aretz. There's Shamayim, which is there, and the Aretz is the pathway to get there. Life is about bringing the Aretz to the Shamayim, bringing the land to the heaven, bringing everything back to its source. And that's what man is about. People who are created from the earth and from heaven have the unique ability to connect the two, to be able to take the earth down here and relate it back to God, to see the Kavod Hashem, to see the glory of God in everything, to uncover it, and to be able to bring everything back to its source and to its root. Bereishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz, the world is about bringing the Eretz to the Shamayim, bringing everything back to the Reishit, to the beginning, to its source, the ultimate Makor of God. The brachos with which the Torah ends Sefer Bereishit is exactly this theme, where life is about, through self-understanding, the ability to bring ourselves back to the Reishit, to the Makor, to live a life. And what we instill within our children and help guide our children is to find what makes them unique, to live a life dedicated to God. The Aseh Tov, what makes that Ephraim in them so special? But as we know, it's not just enough to self-actualize oneself and to be involved in bringing ourselves back to God. The second component, as the Orgedaliahu mentioned, is to connect ourselves to the cloud, to connect ourselves to the community. As the Art School Stone Chumash points out, far from being breeding disunity, however, their separate missions were to bring them together because they were like the spokes of a wheel. Though the spokes point in different directions, they are all part of the same wheel and essential to its function. That we have to understand that everything that I can contribute is going to affect the rest of the Jewish people, and I have to have that cognizance of what I do and how my actions will affect other people, and helping them come back to the Makor, helping them come back to the source. And perhaps this is the reason why the Torah ends with the imagery of Yosef speaking to the Jewish people, to his brothers, and to the Jewish people, asking them to bring his coffin up from Egypt. So Salvechik notes in Yemezi Karon, that's very interesting in source, in verse 24 of the last chapter, last psukim of this parsha. It says that Yosef saw all his grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and then Yosef said to his brothers, I'm about to die, swear to me you'll bring up my bones. So why, asks the Rav, is Yosef speaking to his brothers and not to his children? It's because Yosef understood that his brothers perhaps always felt that they needed him, but Yosef never needed them. And that there was this certain sense of disunity, lack of cohesiveness working with the brothers. At the final moments, Yosef says, you know what? Just like I have supported you, I need you as well. I need you to carry up my bones. No one can say they're self-sufficient. We all need each other. And that's why he doesn't turn to his own children. He turns to his brothers, to the rest of the Jewish people, and said, let's form a community. Let's form one that we can help each other out. And I think in conclusion, this is what Sefer Bereishit is about. This is what the parasha is about. Sefer Bereishit ends with the two beautiful lessons at Yaakov Avinu, the legacies he's given to his children. One is the concept of a roeh, where God is a shepherd, where you have to understand there is a reason for things in life, and that you have to have emunah, you have to have faith, and you need to pass this down not only to your children, but to your grandchildren as well. It's a beautiful article I read recently which said a teacher was able to point out which children in the classroom had a relationship with a grandparent. There was a different quality about these children in terms of emotional security and a whole difference with these children. Grandparents, a legacy, great-grandparents, have something very unique to give to children. This is the tears, the snow path that we need to leave our children, the roeh, the shepherd. It's the imagery of Yosef sitting with his great-grandchildren on his lap. The second message of the parsha is a message of Ephraim and Menashe, of understanding that Ephraim comes before Menashe in terms of focusing what makes a child unique. The brachos of Yaakov, of each child, each son, which was what makes them unique. That ability to then bring everything back to the Bereishit, to the Eretz running to the Shamayim, to the Makor, to the source. It's the end of the parsha where it ends with brachos, as Sefer Bereishit begins with brachos. But on a deeper level, it ends with Yosef saying, I need you, my brothers, that we need to have unity among the people. And the only time we have brachos, that's why the book of Bereishit begins with the letter bet, which is a symbol of bracha, is if we have two. One is not a bar bracha. You need to have two. A Yosef needs his brothers. The brothers need Yosef. It ends with this concept of achdus, this type of community, where we need to know ourselves, but we need to know ourselves and how we're able then to affect the community and bring everyone closer to relationship with God.